Okay, we'll start and see who joins in later. There's a which tells a story with regard to a surah Purim that took place with Rabbah and Rav Zaira in attendance. So the Gemara in Megillah Daf Zayin Amud Bet, the Gemara tells us that at that particular Purim banquet, they became so drunk that Rabbah shechted Rav Zaira. He killed him, like literally slaughtered him, according to the literal interpretation of that phrase. Now, many Mefarshim and Rishonim looked to try and interpret what went on there. At the end, when Rabbah realized what he had done, Rabbah davened on behalf of Rav Zaira, and he was able to bring him back to life again. So says the Gemara. The Gemara then has kind of like an interesting story that the next year, when Rabbah wanted to invite Rav Zaira back, Rav Zaira was a little nervous to go back there and declined the invitation. He didn't want to go through the whole story again. So I guess we have to try and develop a perspective as to exactly what happened here. Now, Rav Avram ben Rambam, the Rambam's son, makes a comment that to him it's absolutely clear that the literal meaning is not intended here, that he actually shechted him, that he slaughtered him. So what actually happened there? So an interesting comment that Rav Huttner has in his writings, which I guess opened up an opportunity to understand it a little bit better. And this is what he says. We have a well-known understanding based on the Gemara as well. When Hashem gave Torah at Sinai, there was also a kind of death that took place there. Every time that Hashem, so to speak, the mitzvah emanated from Hashem's mouth, if you could speak that way. The minute the Jewish people heard directly from Hashem, their souls left their bodies. It's based on a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, that this particular idea, describe what happened over there. And so the question, of course, is what happened in order to. So Hashem gave commandment number one. Then the neshamas of the Jewish people departed. Then he gives number, he has to revive the bodies again, puts the neshama back, speaks again. The neshama leaves the body. What was going on there? What was going on there? So we could explain as follows that the idea of neshamas leaving a body could be understood as the spiritual entity of a human being exposed to the spiritual source from whence it came. And if Hashem's mind, so to speak, is the repository of all neshamot, if Hashem's presence comes too close to a human being, the magnetic effect is to the neshama is so enthusiastic and excited about rejoining its origins in Hashem's being, that the neshama just goes. It's not like it was punished and it died. It just leaves. It's like as if a magnet sucked out the neshama because the attraction is so massive. When our neshama is the spiritual part of Hashem that's in us, comes too close to the actual presence of our HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the soul is attracted out of the body. So that's why Hashem had to, in the words of the Chachmei Kabbalah, use the so-called magical effect of dew, which is going to be used in the end of days to be Mechayim Meisim, to bring the dead back to life. Hashem, essentially did the same thing and resurrected the Jewish neshamas that had left their bodies as a result of exposure to Hashem's spirituality. It's interesting that Rav Huttner sort of sharpens a little bit the idea, and he suggests as follows. He says that the whole idea behind this image, the description, is to demonstrate how each individual Jew needs to relate to the acceptance of the mitzvot of Torah. It's almost as if every time there's a new mitzvah that you hear about, it's almost as if there's kind of a new life force that is embodied in the person. So when a person accepts Torah upon himself, the person's old being is replaced by a new being. It's almost kind of like a description of how of the spiritual transformation that takes place when somebody is serious about Kabbalat or Mitzvot. So that's exactly what happened at Mamar Har Sinai. It's almost like a recrystallization of the Jewish neshama as new levels and dimensions are added to it through the giving of each particular mitzvah. And so Rav Huttner suggests that there's kind of like this spiritual experience as each mitzvah was revealed. The neshama was recreated anew, so to speak. Now, the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Peichet, the Gemara there is also quite well known. And the Gemara says that this whole experience of Hashem's closeness to the average, to the Jewish people, somehow attracting the neshama out of the person's body, that whole experience did not give much free choice to the person. It's almost like as if the light of Hashem was so overwhelming, there really wasn't an option but to go along with what happened. And so the Gemara calls it, the Gemara talks of it as saying that there's kind of like a forced acceptance. There's a claim that the Jewish people can have, which means there's kind of a claim that the Jews can have that they never accepted the Torah with full free choice. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was basically saying to them that the light is going to overwhelm you. If you go with it, then good. And if you don't go with it, then this will be your end. The experience of Mamar Har Sinai was so overwhelming that there's kind of like an ironic overpowering of the individual's free choice. And that was always, despite the fact that they reached levels never ever reached ever again since that time. So what Am Yisrael really had to achieve at some point in history was to actually accept Torah with an expression of Bechira, of freedom of choice. And so this is exactly what was interestingly unique about the story of Purim. The Gemara tells us that when the Megillah expresses the fact that Kiblu over Kiblu, that Am Yisrael, after the story of Purim, accepted upon themselves the yoke of Torah, what was happening, says the Gemara, is that at that point in time, the acceptance of Am Yisrael's return to Torah and reacceptance of Torah was on a higher level in one respect than what happened on Purim, because it was accepted totally, voluntarily, wholeheartedly, etc. And the level of enthusiasm that they accepted Torah brought about was an expression of uniqueness that took place in the days of Purim. And there was no coercion about it. I mean, it is interesting to explore that, because one could state that the euphoria of having been spared a genocide and winning a war, you know, is that really a neutral platform? But let's just take the idea as the Gemara describes it, that idea, it means that there was a unique relationship cemented here with our acceptance of Torah after the story of Purim. So Rav Huttner suggests that just as there was an acceptance by, or the effect of the acceptance by Am Israel at Mamre Sinai was such that it renewed the nature of the soul that it, that embodied the Jewish people. So too, every time there's a real acceptance of Torah, that's how it should be. And so the story of Purim was such that the renewal and recommitment to Torah was kind of like a resurrection of the original life force that that one felt as the neshamas were being crystallized at Sinai. And so using this backdrop, one could suggest that this is what's happening here with Rabbah and Rav Zeira. It's not that Rabbah picked up a knife and shechted Rav Zeira, but rather the exposure of Rabbah's Torah to Rav Zeira was of such a magnitude. The madrega, the level, is so high that if you buy into it without a filter, so to speak, the Shomer was so attracted by that Torah type energy that was being generated there. Rab Zaira's inhibitions were just defeated, and there was no defense. And then the Shomer left his body as a result of the exposure, to Rabbah's Torah. Now, of course, it's not like something that we can really relate to, because even being in the presence of great people, but we probably have a little taste of it when you think about the influence of great spiritual people, where, it's almost like your whole entire presence shuts down in awe when you're in their presence. Well, if you soup that up, you can sort of get an appreciation of this suggestion that the shechting of Rav Zeira was kind of a parallel to what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did to Klal Yisrael at Mamre Har Sinai. The exposure to spirituality is so great that the neshama leaves on its own, so to speak. Now, when Rabbah realized that this had taken place, so he had to bring Rav Zeira's neshama back. And it's not always so simple, to get back. The route back is complex. And in order to come back unharmed, you need a roadmap, which Rabbah was able to apply. Now, this could be on a similar level to what we read in Masechet Chagiga, where Arba Nichnasu LePardes, where there were four great Rabbonim, Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Rabbi Elisha Ben Abuya, and Rabbi Akiva. They all meditated. Their neshamas left their bodies. They gained access into the high spiritual realms, and there they witnessed Hashem's presence, or an expression of it, which had disastrous effects on them. And they taka lost their way, not so much physically, but Ben Azai hits it to a mate when he taka lost his way. He couldn't come back down again. Whether it was a voluntary thing that he didn't want to come back down, he took it as an opportunity to say goodbye. But bottom line is he died. But Ben Zoma was mentally affected. He became a sugar. And Elisha Ben Abuya also was mentally affected. And he became a kofer, he became a heretic. And only Rabbi Akiva found his way back. But this idea of being able to have such control mind over matter that the neshama can travel through these spiritual highways to achieve this tremendous exposure, it's this kind of theory that we are applying to this story over here. And possibly this is one way to emulate, understand what happened between Rabbah and Rav Zeira. Now, as far as we are concerned, when we hear the story, we don't unfortunately live on this level. But what we have to try and do is to create some sort of a quasi reenactment of this particular story. So the original episode is Mamre Har Sinai. And the reenacted story is the acceptance of Torah through the Purim event. And so I guess the common denominator that's possible is the energy and motivation that would signify a unique experience, a whole new level of commitment, a crystallizing of our own neshama's life force. And so if a person goes through the story of Purim with the ability to analyze it and focus at the Suda of Purim on lofty ideas, which is difficult the way we often celebrate Purim, but the idea behind it is to at least use it as a catalyst that our commitment to Torah and its learning as a result of the experience of Purim is a hitchatshut of sorts. It's a renewal. And that reinvigoration will essentially be a kiyum, a fulfillment of the nature of what happened at Sinai and the parallel what happened to Am Yisrael Purim time. And the kind of awareness of what could, how far it can go, the rebirth, so to speak, is to be seen through the story of Rabba and Rav Zaira, that every aspect of their bodies were so to speak resurrected. Every aspect of Torah that they were speaking out allowed their neshama to leave their bodies and then come back again. That process of the neshama's departure and return, the renewal of their neshamas, that's kind of the height which, is unimaginable to us, but the principle needs to be understood through there. And Rav Huttner suggests, therefore, that the motivation that will be renewed will give a new sense of how we approach the concept of Torah once we once we sort of have a experience similar to this. And therefore, this probably is what lies behind the mitzvah of Chayav Inish Livusume Befuraya. A person is to get themselves to a point where they reach beyond their regular control, their regular reach of knowledge, such that when they come back down again, the life force is completely renewed with a new itchatshut. And that really is kind of an interesting way of looking at this principle of ada lo yada, that your knowledge, your motivation to engage in Talmud Torah is renewed and reinvigorated through the whole experience of Torah. So this, essentially what's happening over here is the neshama, our neshamas are given a certain boost to be uniquely receptive to Torah on Purim. And if we sort of tap into that, it gives us kind of a new lease on Torah life, so to speak, as our enthusiasm starts to grow. So that's Rav Huttner's take on this famous Agarta in Masechet Megillah. The idea of Rabba shechting Rav Zaira is the exposure to a potential for the neshama to have a triat ha-metim, a renewal and a reinvigorated spirit when it goes through that particular process. So that's just an interesting idea that Rav Huttner is mechadesh on the story of Rabbi Rav Zaira in the Gemara. Another interesting point that Rav Huttner makes is an interesting description of the nature of Purim and its uniqueness when compared to all the other chagim that we celebrate during the Jewish calendar year. And he focuses on a particular question in Masechet Megillah, Daf Yud Daled, where the Gemara wants to know why Hallel, the recital of Hallel, is absent on Purim. Now, when we look to try and understand, the Gemara suggests an equation. The Gemara says, look, when Am Yisrael, left Mitzrayim, that process of going from slavery to freedom generated an obligation to say hallel. Wouldn't it be all the more so a chiyuv, an obligation to say hallel, when in the Purim story we move from the threat of annihilation to redemption? That the to to say hallel on Purim. So the Gemara has a number of answers, and one of the answers that the Gemara is that we do say hallel on Purim. The hallel that we recite is the actual reading of the Megillah itself. The Megillah is a form of hallel. Now, it's interesting to watch how far certain Rishonim take this idea. In other words, the Gemara is saying that we say hallel. We do say hallel. What's the hallel? The hallel is the Megillah. So what happens if a person is not able to read or hear the Megillah on Purim? Would that mean that you have an obligation to say hallel, and the way we normally do it is via the Kriyat HaMegillah? Now you can't read the Megillah for whatever reason. Maybe not having the chance to read the Megillah, which would normally discharge your obligation to say hallel, since the reading of the Megillah is not there, your obligation to recite hallel is still in play. And therefore, you should actually say hallel. You should say hallel. And this position is known as the opinion of the Meiri, where in his commentary on Shas, in the Beit HaBechira, he taka paskins this way, that if a person is not able to read Megillah for whatever reason, he has to say hallel. But Rav Hutna notes that none of the poskim adopt this chiddush of the Meiri. It's almost like a dati yachid, and he wants to then question, why is it that his equation is actually incorrect? The Gemara says that one must fulfill one's obligation to say hallel on Purim through the Kriyat HaMegillah. So why would no other posek say that since the reading of the Megillah, the recital of regular hallel is inappropriate? So Rav Hutna suggests creatively as follows. Says that hallel is only recited when the miracle that it celebrates is of the following characteristic. It's a public event. It's a revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Hashgacha, providence. It's a revealed miracle. So when we experience Pesach and go through Shavuot, Sukkot, etc., there were miracles there all the time. Those miracles that were ever present, revealed miracles, those miracles, Chanukah, they obligate a recital of Hallel in recognition of those miracles. And the nature of the way that we do it, the recital of Hallel in public, actually mirrors the actual nature of the Nisim that took place on those holidays. So what are we saying? We're saying that a revealed hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a real open miracle, needs an open type of Hallel, a revealed Hallel. And therefore, the actual full recital of Hallel is an apt reaction to a revealed miracle. Yeah, says Rav Huttner, is where Purim differs. The Purim story is only seen retroactively as a unique miracle. But the nature of the lead up to the nais, the lead up to the result that we were let off the hook and given permission to defend ourselves, the build up to that is completely hidden. This is, of course, what's behind this idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name is absent from the Megillah. In order to define the nature of the story of Purim and the miracle that took place as a hidden miracle. Everything about Purim is hidden. The nature of prophecy ceases and is completely absent in the way it was until that point. I was, and Esther were looking as hard as they could for signs of Hashem's guidance to take them through that maze that was set up in front of them in the middle of Persia by Haman, etc. So if the whole story of Purim, as Esther's name implies, was a hidden miracle, so the nature of the Hallel that best a hidden miracle is a camouflaged Hallel. And that's why you don't, until you read the Gemara, it doesn't cross your mind to think that the Kriyat HaMegillah and Hallel are the same thing. But if you start thinking about it, it's a unique type of Hallel specifically apt for Purim. A revealed miracle obligates a revealed Hallel, and a concealed miracle looks for a concealed, camouflaged type of Hallel. So this is exactly the equation that the Gemara is giving us. And therefore, Rav Huttner says this and suggests that if this is the case, that there's needs to be a hidden form of Hallel, this is something that cannot be the obligation of such a type of Hallel. It would not be suitable to use a revealed type of Hallel to fulfill the mitzvah. Because the whole nature of a revealed Hallel, an explicit Hallel, is not suitable for the story of Purim. You need a hidden camouflaged Hallel. This is exactly what lies behind the nature of the Pasuk, which alludes to Esther, you know, at the end of Sefer Devarim, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Vanochi haster astir et panai, I will, you know, surely conceal my presence. That is not just telling you that we're going to struggle in whatever scenario is meant by that phrase, but it's defining how it's going to happen. Everything is camouflaged. And so this is the nature of the whole story. So unlike the Meiri's suggestion that Hallel, that the Megillah replaces Hallel. No, it's not that it replaces Hallel, but rather the Megillah becomes a unique form of Dafka Purim Hallel, on its own. And so this is why, says Rav Huttner, he thinks that most of the poskim rejected the Meiri suggestion. Because Hanami, the concept of is missing if you don't, but the ability to fill that gap needs a similar type of Hallel. And a regular Hallel would not be suitable. And so ultimately Purim is kind of like a watershed in how miracles, how Hashem's divine providence watches over us. From that time on, so many of the aspects of exile, you know, even though they went back and they put a second Beit HaMikdash in operation. But you could feel the difference in the level of Hashem's direct influence as nature of what is happening in the Beit Rishon, compared to a real shallow reflection of what is happening in Beit Sheni. And then from the destruction of Beit Sheni all the way through until today's day and age, the nature of Hashem's involvement with us, it's very rare that we see such open miracles. And even the open miracles are debated about. It is phenomenal that you have, I guess, both on the religious side of things and the secular side of things. If, you know, when you look at modern day miracles, you know, like Yom HaTzmut and Yom Yerushalayim, and there's you know, half the religious, if not more, need convinced that it's actually a miracle, and that it's worthy of at least we would say some type of halal, because it's a miracle, so it needs something. And then you'd have to argue as to what is the appropriate type of halal. So, you know, rather than say, you know, when in the argument of halal, yes, halal, no, I would recommend looking at it, you know, if you took out all the politics, and I would say, okay, you want to argue about what type of halal you should say, you know, but at least there should be a recognition of is it a Purim story type of halal, where everything looks normal, it's a regular kind of a conventional war, even though it's a Rabim Biyad Ma'atim, you know, or, you know, it's like, you know, like it's you know, whatever it is, let the argument at least be that there's a miracle, but the question is what type of halal? There should be something. You've got to say thank you on some level. Then it's a better argument than Mamish saying, there was no miracle bichlal. And so the Purim story is sort of like engages us and forces us to actually recognize, you know, the nature of the type of miracle which we don't appreciate when it comes to the Purim story. And this brings me to the last comment. Again, a chiddush of Rav Hutna, which I've always found to be very apt, especially when you apply it to living in places like Australia. There's a famous midrash. The midrash is found in Mishlei Perek Tet. And the Midrash tells us that when the Megillah describes the nature of the celebration of Purim, it tells you v'zichor yasuf mizaram, you know, that the memory of Purim will never ever cease from the consciousness of Am Yisrael. So the question, of course, is Purim compared to the major Chagim is really kind of like a minor hostel. It's not a, there's no Isra Melocha on Purim. There's no Korban on Purim. Compared to the Shalosh Regalim, you know, the nature of the Yontif, if you will, is does not shine nearly as brightly as the major Chagim. And so when the Midrash comes along and tells us that at the end of days, all the Moadim would become batel, that cease to exist, but Purim somehow would always continue. Purim loid batel. Purim will never ever become nullified. And that's the chiddush of this pasuk. V'zichram lo yasuf mizaram. Not just that the yontif of Purim will be a permanent feature in the Jewish calendar, but at the end of days, when all the other yontifs will not be celebrated anymore, Purim will still be celebrated. So that's the question that I put addresses as to why that would be true. So he says something, he has a fascinating parable, you know, to answer this question. So he says like this, he says, I guess you could, if I sort of dramatize it a little bit, you've got two undercover agents who are brought in to the Mossad and given a mission statement. Each one of them are given a particular assignment. You've got to go and identify certain characters, and you've got to do it completely undercover. The way Rav Huttner puts it, you know, you've got to do it, so to speak, at night. You know, he says, "Shinitstavu la kira nashim balayla." You have to go and identify people, you know, where you can't really see. The one agent was supplied with sophisticated equipment in order to track down this particular person. The second agent was told that his mission is so sensitive that any kind of fancy equipment would draw attention to himself and blow the mission. And so therefore, he's on his own. He's on his own. He's got to use his own intuition. Whereas the agent before him was given a James Bond kit. The way that Rav Huttner puts it is that the one's got a torch that he can shine to see who it is, and the other one is on their own in the dark. And the person who's on their own in the dark, the only way he's going to be able to identify the individual is by recognizing recordings of their voices, so that he knows the voice and he can put the voice from memory to the voice of the person. And I guess their movements and their sounds will be the only clue that the second agent has. Now, there's no question that the person with all the equipment is going to get the job done much, much quicker than the person who's on his own completely. You know, essentially, trying to develop a whole skill set of listening to people's vocals and trying to you know, see a report on how they move and then match it all up in your own mind is much harder. Whereas, you know, if I could shine a torch in the person's eyes, face, I would see what I need to see. So there's no question that the agent equipped with all the sophisticated equipment can do a much better job. However, at the end of the mission, when they both come out of that experience, the person who had no equipment and had to do it all on their own has developed a unique skill set that he never had before. The equivalent of now training himself to listen to the sounds of a human voice and recognize facially who the person is, that level of recognition of people is a unique skill set. It's almost like what happens to a blind person. God forbid. You know, there's no question that his sense of hearing is acutely enhanced compared to somebody like us, who never has to rely totally on that sense of hearing because you've got all of your faculties with you. So having this parable in mind, says Rav Huttner as follows, you know, upon the sun rising the next morning, the first person, you know, packs away all of his sophisticated equipment. He switches off his torch, and he needs it no longer. You know, what value is a torch in the middle of the day? The second individual who developed this unique ability to recognize people in the dark, this ability stays with him forever. And the forced nature of the second person's experience, the difficulty of it, created a unique skill set which remains with the person. When you look at Purim compared to all the other Chagim, you know, what we've said is as follows. Purim is an expression of a hidden miracle. And the other Chagim are all expressions of revealed miracles. We're experiencing a leap year, the 2 months of Adar. Whenever there's Adar Aleph and Adar Bet, the discussion in the Gemara is when to celebrate Purim. Normally, you know, as Zrizin Magdimin, you sort of, you know, you do the mitzvah as early as you can. But Purim is an exception to the rule. Yeah, we celebrate Purim and read the Megillah during Adar Hasheni, second Adar. Why? Because there's a unique relationship between the miracle of Purim and the miracle of Pesach. This is the, and therefore the month of Adar Bet or Purim has to be close as possible to the month of Nisan Pesach. We need to create a link between the two Chagim. Essentially, Am Yisrael were redeemed from Mitzrayim, and as a nation, that was our birth. And it culminated in the experience of Shavuot, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, revealed himself, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Hotzeiticha Meretz Mitzrayim. I'm Hashem, your God, who took you out of Egypt. That revelation is a completely revealed revelation. Miracles daily. Unique miracles, often. The ability to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Anochiyut, I'm Hashem, your God. The ability to recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu is easy, meaning it's right there in front of your face. All you have to do is turn on the torch. Whereas revealing HaKadosh Baruch Hu or seeing Hashem through the fabric of the story of Purim, i.e. the fabric of exile, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is completely camouflaged. You know, Vanochi Haster Astir. You know, I'm completely concealed. These are the equivalent of the two agents looking to identify the target, which is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So you know, in both yontifs, in both days, the action of the experience is defined by the word Anochi, Hashem, Hashem's presence. You know, Anochi Hashem Elokecha b'mamad har Sinai, v'Anochi Haster Astir et Panai on Purim. There, in both cases, there's a mission to identify HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But even though the mission was there in both cases, they're very different because there are two different methods to identify HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The first is the revealed Anochi of Yetziat Mitzrayim. And this Anochi is compared to the person who's able to identify whoever he's looking for by using all sorts of sophisticated equipment. And there's another way to recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that is the ability of Am Yisrael to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the darkest of spaces, in Auschwitz. This is a unique talent. And it's foisted upon those people that are, you know, that have gone through all these terrible times. And this is exactly what so many people in Eretz Yisrael, are going through now. You know, unfortunately, the October 7, we will be victorious, we will win, but the casualties have been so harsh, and the hostages are still there. We're all davening for a Purim miracle, And we're gonna t it's gonna take us decades to recover. And there's this cloud that hangs over Am Yisrael and the relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know. But in the end of the day, once we get through this darkness and we are able to somehow reflect on the story, we'll see HaKadosh Baruch Hu through this as well. And those of us living in our generation who are forced to see, to identify HaKadosh Baruch Hu, without any fancy equipment of prophecy and other great levels of spirituality, but those of us sitting in the darkness with no equipment, and the only way we can recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu is to listen to what's happening around us and somehow intuitively feeling what's going on, looking at what's happened to find Hashem's hand in all human events, when nothing is self-evident. In the end of the day, when we come out of this kind of experience, and Mashiach eventually arrives, Mashiach ultimately is the equivalent of Yetziat Mitzrayim on steroids. In other words, the ability to see Hashem will be impossible to miss, impossible to deny. And therefore, it's like HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence is absolutely revealed, just like it was on Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, Chanukah, etc. The coming of Mashiach ultimately is such a powerful light that it eclipses all other lights that shine a light on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's providence. You know, when Mashiach comes, it's going to be so overwhelming. We say to ourselves, "Ach, Egypt was nothing compared to this. Every other miracle was nothing compared to this. The revelation at Sinai was nothing compared to this." And that's what it means. That's what it means that all other yontifs will not be observed come Mashiach time, because Mashiach's presence of a revealed miracle over, you know, it's like shining a torch in the middle of the day. The sun just the torch is there. The miracle of Mashiach overpower everything else, just into insignificance. But the Anochiut, the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that exists through the Purim story, is really a unique skill set that you know, the people living through the Midbar and other generations of great spirituality were not did not have to go through, because they could see HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a revealed form. We have to like work hard to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu without any help whatsoever. And so this is the unique quality of Purim. At the end, when Mashiach comes, Mashiach represents seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed. All other yontifs fall under that same umbrella, and Mashiach is the most powerful out of all those lights. Whereas the Purim story, even though it's not nearly as sophisticated in as a method in revealing Hashem, but it's a uniquely different approach. You've got to see Hashem in darkness. Mashiach doesn't eclipse it. Even Mashiach won't eclipse it. Those of us who survive exile, those of us who survive these experiences, will have a way of identifying HaKadosh Baruch Hu that even Moshe Rabbeinu never had as such. And this is the unique nature of, you know, of the Yontif of the celebration of Purim. And that's why Vezichram lo yasuf mizaram, the story of Purim and the celebration, the skill set that Purim brought us, is a unique, it's a unique knowledge of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a unique understanding of how to see Hashem, you know, through history. It's very different than seeing a pure expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is the Adeloyada of Purim. The Adeloyada of Purim is the ability to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, even when there's no way to see it, even though when it's completely camouflaged. So anyway, those are the ideas that I wanted to share with you. I wish you well, and Bezrat Hashem, we will reconvene either over the Shabbos or next week this time. Kol Tov, have a good evening.
Thank you.
Okay, be well.